You might step on glass.
No, really, it's all good, she says, glancing at Nathaniel with a look, like it's a private joke she's tossing at him. But he doesn't catch it. He used to be a really good catcher, back when he played first base. Not because he cannot, but because he dares not. This has already gone way too far. There's really no need for this. But the doctor has pulled out a penlight and is examining Nathaniel's eyes. Heterochromia, he declares. Is that like a hematoma? Haroon asks. No, it's when you have different colored eyes. Though the left pupil here is really fixed. You mean the pupil in my prosthetic eye? Nathaniel asks. Right, of course. You threw me with the different colors. But I like it. Is it a kind of David Bowie homage? Can we get on with the exam? Freya asks impatiently. We don't have all day. The doctor rolls his stool over to the computer. Okay, Nate, I'm going to ask about symptoms, and you answer on a scale of 0 to 6. 0 being not a problem, 3 being moderate, 6 being severe. Got it? I think so, Nathaniel replies. Headache? Yes. 0 to 6? It's a 4, but he doesn't want anyone to worry. Maybe a 2? Pressure in the head? Yeah. Maybe 3? Blurred vision? It's all good now. A number? 0, maybe 1? The doctor goes through the list. Neck pain, balance problems. Nathaniel answers in a monotone. 2, 3, 2. How about sadness? The doctor asks. Sadness? Yeah, sadness. You want me to rate sadness? Yep, the doctor says. 0 to 6, please, Nate.
Freya is over it. Over doctors who pretend to know everything, who act like they can fix her, who ask what's wrong without reading a chart, who ask people to sing happy birthday or to measure sadness on a scale of 0 to 6. His name is Nathaniel, she snarls with an irritated confidence she has no right to. For all she knows, he goes by Nate.
He does not, though his father calls him Nat.
And what does it have to do with the concussion? Haroon asks. Is this doctor even a doctor? He scans the walls for a medical school diploma. Hey, I don't write the checklist, the doctor says, fully out of patience. So how about you give me a number so I can get you out of here? Sadness, 0 to 6? No, he can't give you a number, Haroon says. You can't measure sadness in numbers, Freya agrees. So how would you measure it? The doctor asks. Please do tell, so I can refer it to the American Academy of Neurology. The question is asked in a most scathingly sarcastic tone, but Freya, Haroon, and Nathaniel all ponder it seriously.
Freya thinks of music, and then silence, and being totally alone.
Haroon thinks of love and family and get the fuck out of my life.
Nathaniel thinks of his father and Sam and Frodo and a house being swallowed up by the forest. They may be complete strangers with different lives and different problems, but there in that examination room, they are measuring sadness the same way. They are measuring it in loss. The Order of Loss, Part 4. Nathaniel.
Nat, you gotta come see this!
Dad called the minute I walked in the door. I took a breath and pushed back against the irritation. I was sweaty from baseball practice, and I needed to shower and do Dad's breakfast and lunch dishes and get dinner going. And I needed to go online to register for a free SAT prep course. The day before, my mother had called me, wanting to know if I'd started thinking about college. You're going to be a junior. Has your father even started this process? I assured her he had, fumbling some lie about arranging to visit schools together, which is something I knew a couple of kids had done with their parents. Mom didn't press. The woman who'd once said she couldn't live with two children now had two new children and her hands were full, so I knew she wouldn't follow up. Still, I'd made an appointment with a guidance counselor and had seen her earlier that day. "Nat, hurry up!" Dad called from the living room. Sometimes if I ignored him, he got distracted. Most of the time, he only got more insistent, and it became that much harder to calm him down. It was better to see what had gotten him all riled up, talk to him a bit, then maybe I could get on the computer. The guidance counselor had been surprised I hadn't been to see her before. "Your grades are pretty good. And a sophomore on the varsity baseball team is very impressive," she said. We'd made it all the way to the division finals, and we'd had a few scouts come to our games. "With your grades, you could get into a fine school," she'd said. "Maybe even a partial scholarship if you play baseball. Not a Division I school, but somewhere smaller, if you do well on the SATs. Let's get you set up for a course." "Nat!" I went into the living room. The TV was on, as it usually was since Dad had stopped working. I'd learned to gauge his mood not from how he was acting, but from what he was watching. Cartoons, CNN, Real Housewives meant he was checked out. Documentaries meant he was good. Dad loved documentaries, not because of what they told you, but because of what they suggested. I squinted at the TV. Some guy was riding a bicycle. "Yeah?" I said. "The guy riding the bike is blind." Dad smiled triumphantly, but I knew there was more. There was always more. "Hear that sound?" It was faint but unmistakable, like a woodpecker. "He's clicking," Dad said. "Like a bat." "Echolocating," I said. Dad snapped his fingers. "Exactly. He's been doing that since he was little, when he lost both his eyes to cancer. He does not have eyes, but he can see. Literally see." "You can't literally see if you don't have eyes." "Can't you?" Dad asked with that glimmer in his own eyes. And I sighed because I knew what that meant. "It got me thinking," Dad continued. And then he was off to the races. His latest theory he wanted to try out. If a blind man could see with other parts of his brain, what else might we be able to do? "We put up roadblocks in our mind that limit us, but we can remove those blocks too. What was it William Blake said? If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite." His speech started to pick up speed, as it did when he really went on a tear. Soon he would be breathless, the thoughts coming too fast for him to keep up. "Do you see? Do you see?" he asked. "What if we could unlock, if we could just set our minds free?" He stopped to knock himself on his temple, not softly to make a point, but with intensity, like he wanted to punch his brain. I gently grabbed his hand and held it in my lap until he calmed down. "Don't you see?" Dad's voice was a reverent whisper. "What it means is that the only limitation on how we live our lives is up here." He touched my temple this time, gently. He reached for two strips of heavy cotton, cut, I saw, from one of the few sets of intact bedsheets we still had. "Let's go into the forest," Dad said. "Let's go see if we can't expand our consciousness." I didn't want to expand anything. I had homework to do, an SAT prep course to register for. The day's dishes were still sitting on the table, and dinner needed to be started. But I knew if I didn't go, Dad would go without me. He wanted to walk deep into the woods, but I managed to steer him toward a clearing not that far away, a place clear of obstacles, cliffs, large boulders. It was where, 4 years earlier, we had scattered Grandma Mary's ashes. "I'll do you first," Dad said. "Okay." I had no intention of staying blindfolded, of echolocating. I was here to make sure Dad didn't fall off a cliff. I let Dad put the blindfold on me. He tied it tight, and the darkness was sudden and absolute. I carefully sat down on a fallen log, so Dad, who wasn't dumb, would think I was participating in this activity and not just humoring him. At first, I felt the familiar, itchy crawl of impatience. How long would this go on? But as I sat there in the darkness, something strange began to happen. It was like someone turned up the volume of the forest. I could hear the sound of a leaf falling to the earth, of it degrading to mulch. I could hear the beavers pushing stones into the river. And then I was hearing past the forest. In the darkness, I heard a bell ringing in a far-off church. I heard an airplane flying at 40,000 feet. I heard the sound of a girl singing. And then the other senses kicked in. I smelled dates, as if the seeds Grandma Mary and I had planted had borne fruit. I tasted flavors I could not describe. That was the maddening thing about my father. Just when you wanted to write him off as a nut job or a Peter Pan, he would make you go traipsing blindfolded through the forest, and you would touch the hem of something mysterious. "God damn it!" Dad yelped. "Shit!" I yanked off my mask and light returned, and the secrets the forest had been ready to tell quieted themselves. There was Dad, clicking wildly, flailing his hands, teetering toward a ditch. "Dad!" I took off running. "Dad, wait!" I caught up with him a few feet before the ravine, but he kept going, wildly windmilling his arms around. "Dad, stop!" I reached out to yank him back, but he jerked forward, snapping a green tree branch that ricocheted back with the force of a whip. I didn't feel pain. It was only when I felt the blood, warm and trickling down my cheek, that I knew something had happened. "Dad," I called. "I think I'm hurt." He didn't turn around. "You're fine," he said. The blood was running into my mouth now, the vision in my left eye going murky. "I'm bleeding." "If a blind man can see, you can handle a little blood." It was more than a little, but I knew when he was too far gone. "Put some leaves on it," Dad said. "Who knows? Maybe they'll have antibacterial properties like the tree frog." He'd watched a documentary about that years ago. "Dad, you can't discover things if you don't take risks. You'll be fine." "Dad, imagine if Frodo and Sam gave up every time they hit a hiccup. Imagine that." I knew better than to argue with him when he got like this. My choice was either to go back home and take care of it, or to wait out here with him. I waited out there in the woods for at least another hour, as my father expanded his consciousness and I bled into soggy leaves. By the time we got back to the house, my eye had swollen shut. I went into the bathroom and cleaned up the cut as best I could. When I came out, Dad was in the kitchen, cleaning up the dishes and running the garbage disposal, something he never did. "That was life-changing, wasn't it?" he said. He glanced at me, finally noticing the wound. "You should put some ice on that." Except there was no ice in the freezer, and it was late and I had to start dinner. So I put a washcloth on it, figuring it would get better. It had stopped hurting and was beginning to itch. I stayed home from school the next day because I'd slept badly and I looked awful. The eye was puffy and swollen shut. I briefly thought about going to the doctor, except we didn't have a doctor, aside from the one Dad went to at the free clinic in town to get his meds. I thought of going to the ER, but worried about how much it would cost and what would happen if it got back to Mom. I was getting too old for custody battles, but I couldn't be too careful. Dad stayed locked in his room, scribbling in his notebooks. He would be like this until the fever broke, and then he'd be on to the next documentary, about serial killers, about mountain gorillas, about salt, about suicide tourism, that would click an idea in his brain and send him running again. When I woke up the following morning, my eye was on fire, an ooze of bloody pus trickling down my cheek. I went to the nurse's office at school and was immediately sent to the ER. And it was there that the doctors said the entire socket was infected and the eyeball itself had been deprived of blood for so long the tissue was probably dead. The eyeball would likely have to be removed. The surgery was delayed because we needed parental consent and Dad was not answering his phone. I made up a story about how he was a writer and turned off his phone when he was working. It wasn't that far from the truth. "What about your mother?" they asked me. My mother could not find out about this. I'd see to that just as I'd made sure she'd never found out about the week we'd gone without electricity, or the time Dad had left me in the forest all night. "Don't tell your mother." "My mom's dead," I told the doctors. They eventually got hold of Dad, and I was rushed into surgery. I woke up alone, in a dark room, and knew my eye was gone. As I lay there, groggy, my head throbbing, I wanted someone to wrap their arms around me, to kiss my forehead, to tell me things would be okay. But nobody did. Tentatively, I touched the gauze packing around my eye and realized, with equal parts terror and relief, this secret would be impossible to conceal from my mother. Because she would see, and she would know, and if she knew, she wouldn't let me stay here. Would she? My father came into the room, and when he saw me awake, he began to weep. "Oh, Nat. Oh, buddy," he said. "Look at you." At the sight of my father doubled over, sobbing, I understood that I would not tell my mother. The decision had already been made long ago. And with that, the lie I'd told the doctors about her being dead suddenly became true. To keep the secret from her, I'd have to keep myself from her. The realization sent a bolt of fury through me, shaking off the remaining sedation. In that terrible, tiny moment, I didn't just hate my father. I wished he were dead. But the moment passed, leaving me exhausted and hung over with shame. I didn't hate my father. I loved him, and he loved me. He had begun sobbing convulsively, like he'd heard my horrible thoughts. I knew if I didn't calm him down, it would only get worse. So I told him what I'd already learned people wanted to hear. "It's all good. But you lost your eye," he said. It couldn't be saved, the doctors had told me. So I saved the only thing I still could. Or I tried to. "Maybe I had to lose the eye to gain sight," I told him. The look on his face, it was so hopeful it was painful. "Really? You really think so?" I didn't think so. I didn't believe half of what my dad said anymore, but I couldn't write him off completely. Because he was occasionally right. And because he was Dad. And we were a fellowship of two. "Really," I told him.
The Order of Loss, Part 5. Freya. The first video really was an accident. People didn't believe that. They thought it was part of the concocted narrative. But it was the one detail of all of this that Hayden didn't invent. It just happened. Sabrina had been right. 2 years later, our father was still gone. The promises to come back, to have us visit him, turned out to be made of smoke. The weekly Skype calls had begun to dwindle, and on the phone he was vague about his life. He no longer asked if I wanted to visit. He no longer asked me if I sang. But I did still sing. Only with Sabrina now. Every day. After school, Sabrina made the snacks, grilled cheese sandwiches with sliced tomatoes, and helped me with my homework. She was a far better student than me, straight A's across the board. When homework was finished, we listened to music together, picking apart songs we loved, seeing if we could sing them better. Sometimes we went online, watched videos on YouTube. Other times, we went on Facebook, trying to get a glimpse of our father. Back when he lived here, it had been his professional page, with videos of him playing gigs or offering music lessons after Mom had come up with the idea that he should teach to earn some money. These days, the posts showed him at church, at family meals, smiling broadly, arms around aunts and uncles and cousins we'd never met. Did he miss us? I couldn't tell. The status updates were usually in Amharic. That day, we were scrolling through Facebook when we came upon a picture of a woman holding a baby bundled in a green blanket. There was a caption in Amharic. "Let's look it up," Sabrina said, and we pasted the words into a translation program. I thought it would say something about a new nephew, a new cousin for me, but the translator spat out, "Finally, we have a son." And suddenly, I understood why the phone calls had dwindled. I began to cry. Something I did often, which irritated Sabrina, who never cried. But this time, she patted me on the shoulder. "I'm sorry," she said. Her pity made me cry harder. She looked at the screen. "Solomon doesn't deserve your tears. Solomon, not Dad. I mean, how could he forget you like this? You, as if it only affected me. You know what you should do? You should post a song or something. Show him how amazing you are, what he's lost." "Sing what you can't say," my father had said. That was what Billy and Nina and Josephine and Gigi did. "Okay. Let's clean you up first." Sabrina mopped my face with a washcloth and carefully did my makeup. "Do you know what you want to sing?" she asked. "Yes, I wanted to sing Tachai Chailu, the lullaby my father had sung to me and that he would now be singing to his new son." I fetched an empty trash can for accompaniment, and Sabrina hit record. My intention had been to send a greeting to my new brother, a reminder to my father. But when I started singing, something else came out. Something primal and aching and pure. I kept singing, drumming even harder, and my voice went places it had never been before. When it was over, I felt better. Just like the night when Sabrina first sang with me. I didn't even want to post it. Singing the song was enough. "Oh, we're definitely posting it." Sabrina uploaded the video onto her Facebook page. "Huh," Sabrina said the next day when we checked on the post. She'd tagged our father, so the video had shown on his page, but he must have untagged himself because it was no longer there. But on her own page, we saw that the video had been shared 67 times. It had garnered more than 100 comments, some from Sabrina's friends, but others from people I didn't know. I was devastated that my father had untagged himself. Why would he do that? Was he embarrassed about us? Ashamed that he'd left us? Did he not like the video? The only thing that eased my pain was all the comments. Later, when Mom came home and Sabrina was helping her with dinner, I read them all, twice over. They were so nice, and they filled the hole my father's silence had left. I took a copy of the video and edited it down and posted it on Twitter. By the next day, The video had hundreds of shares, thousands of likes, and so many more comments. I read them all, and read them again. They made me feel so good. I showed Sabrina. "Why'd you post it again?" she asked. "Solomon probably doesn't have Twitter, and he already saw it on Facebook." "Look at how many people shared it, though." Sabrina looked. She seemed unimpressed. "Maybe we should show Mom." "Yeah," she said. "I'm sure she'll love that you sent our father a song." "But it's weird that it got so many shares." I tried to sound casual. "It kind of went viral. We should tell her before she finds out from someone else." Sabrina sighed. "Fine, I'll show her." "Huh," Mom said. "I've been reading about how the internet is creating a new kind of star. There's potential for actual money." "How?" Sabrina asked. "I'm not sure," our mother said. "Let's post another one. Why don't you do it together this time? You girls sing so beautifully. What do you think, Sabrina?" Even back then, there must have been a small acorn in my heart, because I felt it, nubby and shriveled and shouting, "What about me?" when Mom said that. "I was the one born singing. I was the one who'd gotten all those likes from my video. But no one asked me." "Okay," Sabrina said. "Why not?" The first few videos were duds. But Mom, under the thrall of the path, was convinced if she dreamed it hard enough, it would happen. She began reading up on what made successful videos. She determined that we needed a hook, a look, and a sound. The sound was mostly dictated by covers. We hadn't started writing our own material yet. The look was my doing. I wanted us to look like Billy and Josephine and Gigi. And the hook was that we were sisters who looked nothing like sisters. "What should we call you?" Mom asked. "The Kabide sisters?" Sabrina wrinkled her nose. "The sisters Kabide," she tried. She shook her head. "Sounds weird." She paused, tapping her fingers against her chin. "What about the sisters K?" "The sisters K," Mom said. "I like that." By the time we were summoned to Hayden Booth's offices 4 years later, the Sisters K had a YouTube channel, 220,000 subscribers, an Instagram feed, 780,000 followers, a Twitter account, 375,000 followers, an official Facebook page, and several fan pages, and a SoundCloud channel with more than 20 original songs. We also had a manager, Mom. She watched other people's successful videos obsessively, trying to figure out what worked and what didn't. She mapped out weekly schedules, analyzed web traffic to determine when we should post. She stayed up late into the night, monitoring the comments and shares. When our videos earned the first bit of advertising money, she used it to hire a consultant to help us hone our look and leverage, or, as she said, monetize, our growing popularity. "It's interesting," the publicist said, going through some of the comments. "They seem personally invested in Freya." "Probably because she responds to all of their comments," Sabrina said dismissively. "Every single one." I blushed and looked down, embarrassed and ashamed. Because Sabrina was right, I did read every comment, and I responded, in the early days, to nearly all of them. It was the only thing that made me feel like I was part of this. Though we called ourselves the Sisters K, it was really the Mom and Sabrina show. Sabrina and I might have sung together, and we sometimes wrote songs together, but she and Mom discussed every aspect of the business, and she went to Mom with every new song we wrote. They conspired. They plotted. And our family went back to being a three-legged chair. The comments, however, were all mine. When I started replying to fans, they began addressing me directly. While Mom and Sabrina sat in front of one computer analyzing engagements, talking about me, I could quietly open my phone and really engage, knowing someone would be there for me. "Actually," the publicist told us, "that's a really smart strategy. It makes the fans feel like they're a part of your success. Those kinds of superfans are the ones that'll take you from a novelty act to the next level." "Wonderful," Mom said. "Freya, keep doing what you're doing. Sabrina and I will keep up on our end." We began to earn more advertising money from our videos. Mom went from full-time to part-time at her job as a hospital administrator. She read articles about the highest-paid internet celebrities. "Some of these people make millions." She was convinced we could make some good money from this. Enough to get out of debt, pay for college, and who knew, maybe even get a little rich. But Hayden Booth, not even Mom, deep in the throes of Dream It Be It, imagined Hayden Booth would come knocking. When his office called to request a meeting, Mom was shaken, almost scared, like she'd been summoned by God. When you read articles about Hayden Booth, which Mom did obsessively after he called, he was sometimes described as a music producer, other times a talent manager, other times a social media aggregator. "There wasn't a word for what I did before I came along," he bragged in one of those articles. "I just call myself a creator." His origin story had become a thing of myth. 10 years ago, he'd been a scrappy club kid from London, broke and backpacking through Berlin when he saw this girl busking on the U-Bahn. He'd listened to her sing and play guitar and seen her entire trajectory right away. It was like a vision. He didn't know how, but he knew she could be huge, and he could be the one to get her there. When she finished singing, he approached her, not even knowing if she spoke English, and said, "I'm going to make you famous." And he did. He told us a version of that story at our first meeting, when, after having us wait for 2 hours in the reception area, he finally invited us into his office and sat us down on a bench that felt like concrete, while he sat in his throne, backlit by the bank of windows behind him. When he finished telling us how he'd made Lulia, and then Melange, then Rufus Q, he said he was always on the hunt for who was next. He looked at me, eyes open and unblinking. It was terrifying. I cast my gaze around his office in search of a safe haven, looking out the window, at the wall, at his weird graffiti art print that read, "Art is personal, business is not." Anywhere but at Hayden. Finally, he asked, "Do you know what it means to be famous?" Mom started to answer, but Hayden held up his hand and she went quiet. "From them." There was a pause. Sabrina looked at me, her face uncharacteristically uncertain. "To be known for what you do?" Sabrina said, at the same time I said, "To be loved." "My CPA is known for having creative ways of hiding money from the IRS. Is he famous?" he asked Sabrina. Sabrina shook her head. and my granny was beloved. But I bet you've never heard of Pauline Howarth, have you? He asked my mother. She shook her head. Most people don't know what fame is. They confuse fame with celebrity. Celebrity with buzz. But I'm going to tell you how it works. He said this like he was divulging a secret. He stood up and stalked around the desk, leaning on the edge of it closest to Sabrina. First, you've got buzz. He cupped his left hand into the shape of a C. You girls already have that. But buzz is cheap. It's your 15 minutes of fame. It's what a daft woman in a Chewbacca suit gets. It comes and it goes. Unless... Here, he cupped his other hand into a C. Buzz sustains enough to become celebrity, which lasts a bit longer, but is still built on quicksand. Now, if celebrity can be translated into commodity, you're onto something. You can dine out on that. Sports stars, B-list actors, reality TV stars, second-rate musicians get this far. An endless loop of buzz, celebrity, commodity. Here, he joined his two hands together, so they made a circle, the fingers not quite touching. You can ride that train pretty far, make a living that way, but it's still not fame. He paused. His fingers began to flutter, like wings of a bird wanting to take flight. Mum here has done a bang-up job getting you girls this far. You two might even make some good money for a while, get some decent endorsements and revenue. But I promise you this, it won't last more than a few months, or, if you're really lucky, years. But sooner or later, probably sooner, people will be on to the next shiny thing, and it won't be you. When that happens... Your fans will forget you, your numbers will drop, and you'll go back to being like everyone else. So how do we keep that from happening? Mom asked. That brings us to fame, Hayden said, ignoring her. Sometimes, if you're talented, if you have that something extra, and if you're surrounded by the right people... You stand a shot at breaking out of that loop, out of celebrity, which is ephemeral. Here he exploded his hands wide open, his bird fingers soaring to the heavens, and into fame, which is eternal. Hayden's phone began to ring, rattling on the desk. The screen flashed, Lulia, as if the universe wanted to confirm what Hayden had said. Fame, Hayden continued. That's what I do. I create fame, but only under the right circumstances, with the right artists, those who are talented enough and hungry enough. Here, he stopped to look at me. The question is, are you hungry enough? I had no idea if I was hungry enough. What that even meant. What he was promising. But I had understood one thing. Your numbers will drop. Your fans will forget you. I knew what that meant. Are you hungry enough? Hayden repeated. Mom and Sabrina spoke as one. Answering as they always did for me. We are, they said.
The Order of Loss, Part 6. Haroon. I found James because of a dollar bill and lost him because of a 50. Which is oversimplifying, but how else do you explain something as inexplicable as love? Yo, you dropped this? I looked up. There was James, holding up a crumpled dollar bill. I don't think so, I stammered. It was my first week at the community college, and though the campus was small and in the city where I'd spent all my life, I was lost. Clutching my schedule and map, I was trying to find the building my statistics class would be held in. I looked up from my printed schedule and saw his face for the first time. Everything about him seemed to suggest warmth. The glow of his dark skin, the goatee that made him look like he wore a permanent smile, the brown eyes twinkling like he was in on the best joke. "Where you need to be?" he asked me. And I had the strangest thought. Right here is where I need to be. James grabbed the schedule. "You're at Newkirk. You need building G on the other side of Bergen. Let me show you," he said, and took me by my elbow, which subsequently caught fire. I paid no attention in statistics that day. I just rubbed my still-tingling elbow and thought of the boy with the laughing eyes whose name I did not even catch and whom I would likely never see again. So when I came out of the building and saw him leaning against the bike racks, my first thought was that it was a miracle. Then I remembered it couldn't possibly be that. But when he asked me if I wanted to grab a coffee, it did seem like some sort of divine intervention. We talked for 2 hours straight, pausing only to breathe. James told me he was in his second year of school, studying food management in hopes of becoming a chef. He watched cooking shows obsessively and could take any 5 ingredients and turn them into something delicious. He was an only child, raised by his mom, until one weekend she dropped him off with his father and never came back. He'd recently moved out of his father's house and was now crashing with a cousin in the Heights while he figured things out. I told James that I was studying business and accounting in hopes of one day taking over, or, if Ummi had anything to say about it, expanding my parents' auto supply business. I told him how Abu had gotten a green card from the lottery when he was 19, arriving at JFK with one suitcase. For 10 years, he worked 3 jobs, sometimes 20-hour days, sending money home each month and saving what he could until he had enough to buy a business. Only then did he go back home to find a wife. I told him about Ummi, moving to a strange land to live with a husband she barely knew, arriving in winter and feeling assaulted by the cold. She had cried every day and hadn't left the house until she saw the first crocus, at which point she'd walked to Abu's store and asked him to give her something to do. He'd taught her to do his accounting, and now she did it for so many businesses she had to turn down work. Abu sometimes joked that it was a good thing they were married, otherwise she'd have no time for his books. At 6, Ummi texted, wanting to know where I was. James and I exchanged phone numbers, and the rest of the week we kept up the conversation via texts. "Who are you texting?" Halima asked. The lie flew out automatically. "Jabir."
"Is that a new friend from school?"
Ummi asked. "Yes," I said. That night, I changed James's name in my contacts to Jabir and started deleting his texts at the end of each day. We met for coffee again, at my suggestion, away from campus, in one of those expensive cafes on the walking mall. "You seeing anyone?" James asked me casually.
"Not at the moment," I said.
"Not at the moment," he repeated, a teasing drawl, as if he already knew the truth.
"I've never seen anyone," I admitted. "I've never done anything with anyone." For a second, I was scared he'd laugh at me or reject me. But he just ran his finger across the rim of his coffee mug, nodding as if it all made sense to him. As if I made sense to him. "I take it you're not out to your family?" he asked.
"I'm not out to anyone,"
said me.
The revelation stunned me, but in a good way, like I'd been a can of soda on a shelf, all quiet and dusty, until someone had come along and shaken me. For the first time in my life, someone else knew who I was. The realization left me giddy, lightheaded, drunk, or what I imagined drunk to be like. "Except you," I told James. James smiled and licked his lips. "Seeing as you told me a secret, I guess I owe you one back. You already told me about that singer you're obsessed with." "Freya." He shook his head. "Nah, not her." He cast his eyes downward, a little creep of red at his sideburns. He was embarrassed. I was a goner. "You didn't drop that dollar bill." He paused. "I did."
"You did? Why?"
His eyes were slow and sleepy, coming up to greet mine like a morning sunrise.
"To meet you."
And with that, the can was shaken even harder, and the fizzy sensation grew more powerful than it had been that night with Aladdin, more powerful than it had been with all the crushes on boys real and make-believe whom I had fantasized about over the years, but never really allowed myself to imagine being with.
"Got another secret for you,"
James said. He leaned across the table and beckoned me closer. His mouth was near my ear. His finger was on the tab.
"If he opened that can, there would be no going back."
"What?" I asked. "Entire body liquid.
I'm gonna kiss you now," he whispered.
"I thought March was supposed to be in like a lion, out like a lamb,"
James muttered that frigid day a year and a half later.
"And it's almost April. Ain't supposed to be this cold."
James wasn't living in Jersey anymore, not going to school anymore, which is why we'd taken to meeting Thursdays in the city. He complained that one day a week wasn't enough, and I didn't like it either, but some days we were together 10 hours, and I justified that, amortized over a week. It wasn't that bad. James hated the cold in general, but particularly on our Thursdays, when it was a stinging reminder that we had no place to go. He'd been kicked out of his father's place before I met him, and had been bouncing from friend to relative ever since, first in the Heights, later on the Grand Concourse, and now in Inwood, with a sympathetic aunt who mostly worked nights.
"Come spend a night,"
he wheedled.
I wanted to, but I couldn't.
"You could if you told your family,"
James said.
"And how did that work out for you?"
It was a low blow. I'd since learned that the reason James didn't live with his father anymore was that his father kicked him out after James told him he was gay. But it illustrated my point. And for this reason, it usually shut James up. When it was cold outside, we'd meet and go to a cafe, station ourselves there for hours, and dream about being somewhere else.
"One day, we'll go to Brazil, or to Fiji," James would say.
He'd seen pictures of tree houses in the Amazon. Fijian bungalows perched right over water as blue as a swimming pool. He'd pull up the images on his phone and show me.
"You'll be a pilot and fly us everywhere we want to go," he said,
even though James knew I'd long since put away my dreams of being a pilot, long since stopped plane watching.
"Sometimes I tried to picture us hiking through the rainforests, diving into that impossibly blue water, but it was like trying to read a book in a dream. I could never quite see it."
That cold spring day, Fiji seemed farther away than ever. I steered James toward the nearest Starbucks, knowing a hot chocolate and a warm corner were the best we could do. But he didn't want to go there. He didn't want to go anywhere.
"I'm tired of this,"
he muttered. "Tired of this" was a fist to the gut. "Tired of this" really meant tired of me.
"Is it because I'm black?"
James asked.
"Christian?
Can't do nothing about black, but I could convert. I had an uncle who was Nation of Islam for a while."
It took me a moment to understand what he was saying, that he thought his not being a Muslim was the deal-breaker with my family.
That wouldn't help. At least I'm willing to try, he said.
You think they'd invite you for dinner? Be happy for us to have sleepovers?
I shook my head, angry. My mother didn't speak to my brother for 6 months after he married a white woman.
So you're just gonna keep doing like this? Keep lying to them and to yourself because you're too chicken shit to be true? How am I lying to myself? Everything you do is to keep playing the good, dutiful son, and it's all bullshit.
He stopped and looked at me with a withering disgust. Did you ever even tell your parents you wanted to be a pilot?
What does that have to do with anything? All little kids have things they want to be when they grow up. Abdullah wanted to be Bob the Builder. Halima wanted to be a Disney princess. It doesn't mean that's what you're going to do. And anyway, it's not like any American carrier would be eager to hire a pilot named Harun Siddiqui.
See? James said, jabbing me with his delicate finger.
That's just it. You write people off without giving them a chance.
No, I said. I live in reality. James grunted and walked ahead of me. He abruptly stopped, which I thought meant he was ready to make up. He never could stay angry long, but he stooped down and picked something up. It was a $50 bill. My first thought was that he'd done it on purpose, but I knew James did not have spare 50s lying around, and I could tell by the surprised smile on his face that he hadn't dropped it. He'd found it.
We should see if someone lost it, I said. And let someone else take it?
He shook his head.
Aw, hell no.
It's stealing, I said.
It ain't stealing. It's finding. Anyone might have dropped it, but we found it.
It's still wrong. Think of it as a gift from God.
You don't believe in God, I said.
Nah, boo. You're the one who don't believe in God.
Why would you say that?
Because you got no faith.
I didn't know what to do with that.
Got any cash on you?
He asked. I had 20 and some change. James started tapping away on his phone.
Between us, we got almost 90.
There's gotta be some cheap-ass hotel that rents rooms for that much.
He tapped some more on his phone, and then his face broke out into that wide-toothed smile.
Place near Penn Station. Says it's only 93 a night.
We don't have 93.
Close, though. Come on.
We walked to the hotel, the wind, gritty and mean, pushing back against us. The hotel clerk told us the room was actually $125 a night, plus tax. But if we paid cash and left by the end of his shift and didn't use the towels, we could have it for 80. We rode the elevator to the 9th floor. James was shaking when we unlocked the door, but he said it was on account of the cold, and the first thing he did was crank up the thermostat. The room was ugly and dark, with a window that looked out onto an air shaft. When I imagined us being someplace together, it didn't look like this, or like the tropical waters in Fiji. It looked like my house, my bed. That was my running away fantasy. To be able to sleep like spoons in my bed at home with James, not hiding. But that seemed so much further away than the Fijian bungalow. We sat on opposite ends of the bed. We'd wanted this for so long, a place to be together. And now we had it and didn't know what to do. It wasn't like we hadn't had sex. In the hidden corners of Central Park, in the empty ladies' lounge on the top floor of one of the city's old failing department stores, we had explored the hidden reaches of each other's bodies. But those encounters were, by necessity, always fast and furtive. Shirts yanked up, zippers yanked down, the important bits exposed, but always both of us ready to make a break for it. In truth, I was that way with James. Always ready to make a break for it. But here, in this room, with the thermostat cranked, we could take our time. Tentatively, we started to kiss, giggling nervously. We kicked off our shoes. We kissed some more, a little steadier, and peeled off our shirts. We went slow, even though it was agonizing, because for once, we could. By taking our time, I saw things I'd never seen. A rigid scar on his left shoulder. The way the skin of his belly was a different color from the rest of him. More like my tone than his. His feet, the toes, all the same length.
My mom used to call them my ballerina feet, he said when I commented on them.
You never talk about your mom.
Nothing to say.
Did you love her?
What kind of question is that? Of course I loved her.
He paused to bite his thumbnail.
And I know she loved me. But sometimes, that ain't enough.
You always tell me that love is all you need, I said.
Maybe I should start living in reality too.
He replied.
I got that bad feeling again.
I love you, I told him. You know that, right?
But not enough to do something about it. Not enough to risk anything. I told my pops. I didn't think about the consequences.
That's not fair, I replied. You told your father before we met. And, I might remind you, he kicked you out.
I might remind you, he mimicked. Like I could forget. And I told my pops knowing that one day I'd meet someone like you, and when it happened, I'd be ready.
The heater ticked off. The room went cold. I knew what he meant, or what he thought he meant. He told his father to make a place for me. But all I heard in that someone like you was someone other than me.
Nothing's gonna change if you're not willing to change it, he said. And if you aren't, we're gonna keep hiding out, paying off clerks for 5 hours in a hotel.
4 hours now, I said.
And this was your idea.
Fine. You wanna fuck? He unzipped his pants, tugged on mine. At that moment, I wanted the chill in the room to go away. I wanted the distance between us to shrink. I wanted to buy a few more minutes of borrowed time. So I told him yes, I did want to fuck. He lunged for me, and I lunged for him. I didn't know if we were fighting or apologizing, declaring ourselves or saying goodbye, fucking or making love. Maybe all of those. After, we fell asleep curled into each other, like spoons. I woke up, my phone lighting up with calls. It was Ummi. It was after 6. I was meant to be home. I left James in that hotel room, ran to the path, and ran home. I tried to imagine what it would be like to tell my parents, but it was like the Fijian bungalow. It existed somewhere out there in the world, but nowhere I could ever get to. I got home late, concocting some lie to Ummi about losing track of time while studying for a big exam, and braced myself, as I did every Thursday, for the moment when Ummi would see through my lie with that radar of hers that allowed her to find a missing $5 in her client's books, to sniff out any remotely fishy business in their ledgers. But it never happened. She believed me because, unlike the people whose books she did, she trusted me. I pushed the food around my plate, making another excuse about how we'd had pizza during the study session. She frowned, but took my plate, and I ran to the shower to rinse James off my skin. In my bedroom, I checked my phone, but there was no text from James. I was logging on to the computer to see if he'd sent me a Facebook message when Abu popped his head in. I quickly minimized the screen.
Everything okay? He asked.
For the millionth time, I tried to imagine what it would be like to tell him. I am in love, I could say. His name is James. Can I ask you something?
You can ask me anything.
Why did Ummi get so angry when Saif married Lisa?
That woman does not always make it so easy.
I know, but Ummi was angry before she even met her. Abu sighed and came to sit down on the edge of Abdullah's bed.
You must understand, Beta, he told me. Your mother left her family behind to move to America. And sometimes
She feels like America is making strangers of her children. He paused and smiled.
Why? Have you met a girl?